Hey, Dad.
Oh, what?
Why did Joseph accuse Mary of being a prostitute?
I didn't know he did.
Because she made a little profit.
Where is your mother?
You're listening to The Wayward Willis with John and Logan, where two atheists discuss religion, culture, and maybe some politics. If you're offended by blasphemy, profanity, or you hate fun, this podcast may not be right for you. And now, on to the show.
Hey, you.
It's us.
Couple of aliens who picked out some fairly attractive meat suits.
I'm your fairly attractive host, John.
And I'm Logan, a domesticated wildcat.
Semi-domesticated.
Hey, what are you trying to say?
You're going to need to hold on to your butts, dear listeners, because this week we're talking about sodomy.
Oh, God. So terrible butt puns aside, what even is sodomy?
Well, the dictionary defines sodomy as anal or oral copulation with a member of the same or opposite sex, also copulation with an animal. So, yeah, it's not just butt stuff.
That started out pretty great and then took a weird turn.
Yeah, for sure. The definition of sodomy has evolved over time, but has religious roots. In fact, without the Old Testament, we wouldn't even have the word Sodom or sodomite. These terms come from the story of Lot in the book of Genesis.
Bitches be salty, yo.
Good memory. This story, because it's in the Torah, has foundational significance in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Lot and his family lived in the Sodom and Gomorrah Twin Cities metro area.
The OG metropolis.
The SG metropolis, more like up top.
No.
Aww. They had a nice little bungalow in the Sodom city limits and a bunch of fun neighbors who loved to party. After all, these cities were nestled in the Jordan River Valley with plenty of water and greenery, and the people had time on their hands where they otherwise would have been killing each other over the few cacti in the desert.
A spiky death well is mine!
There was only one problem. Lot's family worshipped the fun-hating Jehovah, who over time got tired of the loud music and people parking their camels in his parking spot all the damn time.
Sideways, haphazardly, and with blatant disregard for everyone else on the road. Ha! Callback to a super secret patron-only episode, you non-patrons.
You'd already know that if you were one of the cool kids. Just saying. Anyway, shaking his cane at people and telling them to get off his lawn wasn't working, so he decided he was just going to murder everybody. You know, like loving gods do.
In video game raid terminology, we refer to this as wiping. On a completely nerdy tangent, this is one of my favorite video game terms because it just puts this image in your head that the game you're playing is on a tabletop board with all sorts of different components being little pieces or dice or whatever, and someone's arm just comes in and wipes everything off the board to start it over fresh. So good.
I feel like flipping the table would be more satisfying than that.
Whenever you're in a raid party and somebody has to wipe, that's the verbal equivalent. Everybody is like, oh, again.
So here's the crux of the story, and you can tell me if you think this warrants outlawing of non-traditional sex positions. Jehovah bargains with Abraham over whether or not he should destroy the city because of their, quote, grievous sin, which never gets any clarification. So for all we know, these people could have simply been sacrificing their second best goats and passing them off as the best goats.
Fantastic goats. These goats are tremendous. Nobody has goats like these goats. Hashtag make America goats again.
That was pretty good. So Abe convinces Jehovah to compare the cities if he can find 10 people who aren't human garbage. I actually don't even know what the standard is here. It might just be bakers who only make cakes for the right people.
Too soon.
So he sends two angels, Christopher Walken and Eric Stoltz, to find Abe's nephew, Lot, and deliver the news while hunting for decent people.
Wow. Cool obscure reference, bro. That movie's as old as I am.
It might actually be older.
Like a couple of months older, but came out in the same year.
Because you're a kid.
Fuck you, man. I'm 22 now.
So I can't help but think at this point that if Lot and his wife had been more prolific breeders, it would have been one-stop shopping, and this story would have ended very differently. Alas, they only had two daughters.
No birthright.
And the final tally of the righteous stopped at 4.
Wah, 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 wah.
So, Christopher and Eric eat dinner with Lot's family.
Wait. Angels eat food?
It's a metaphor for hospitality, which becomes important in a minute.
Okay.
So after perching on chairs for a while, the angels decide to go to bed.
Wait. Angels sleep?
It's still a metaphor. So a biblical sleepover is the ultimate way to prove you're a good person.
This sounds really stupid.
Fact. But before they can finish their bedtime story, a mob of sodomites assembles outside of Lot's house and starts asking who their sexy guests are and whether they're into orgies.
This is a totally normal thing to do, by the way. Try it out on your neighbors. I dare you.
Lot reminds them that angels have no genitals and recommends they see the prophecy, director's scroll edition, but they're not having it.
That's so meta, bro.
So they won't go away, and Lot has to think fast. How is he going to save the angels from an orgy and still be a righteous, upstanding man?
There's no way those poor angels will be able to defend themselves. If Supernatural has taught me anything, it's that no one can end someone better than an angel.
Well, yeah, and Christopher Walken. All he has to do is just shush you. So he offers his two virgin daughters to the mob instead. Yeah, nothing says, I'm a good parent, like letting your daughters get brutalized by a mob in order to save two strangers with god powers. Attaboy, Lot.
Or was it like the Hunger Games, and they were like, we volunteer as tribute! Something tells me they weren't too reluctant.
Oof. You know, if you haven't already noticed through this podcast, religious texts are full of fine, upstanding people who do things even a DC supervillain wouldn't do in order to find favor with gods who make poor decisions and lash out impulsively like an idiot reality TV show host with tiny hands.
Holy shit, so many things were just roasted in that little sentence. Bravo. Bravo.
Well, you know, I'm not usually prone to broad sweeping generalizations, but every once in a while I make an exception.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
And look, assuming that this mob just really wanted to have sex with something, they could have chosen each other. Or they could have chosen themselves.
Orgy mob, I choose you.
Right. It makes no sense that these people went searching for someone's two house guests in order to have an orgy. No sense. You can use your non-dominant hand to switch things up and keep the spark alive.
I gotta be honest, I'm far less proficient with my left. There's nothing sexier than a woman with experience. Or, I guess a hand. Don't worry, I'm done now.
Thank you, please. Beyond that, it makes no sense that if they were wanting somebody they hadn't already licked from head to toe, they would have turned down Lot's girls.
His very eager girls.
I mean, thank goodness these people were picky, because this story would have been 100 times worse if they weren't. But it just blows my mind that somebody wrote this and that Lot is the good guy.
Hey, just because he's the protagonist doesn't mean we have to like him.
That's true. So I'm sorry for the sidetrack. Let's wrap up.
Yeah, we've been talking about orgies for a little too long now.
Can you talk about orgies for too long?
Yes, you can.
Okay, moving on. The mob tries to break down Lot's door, so Christopher and Eric strike them all with blindness and they go away.
Ha! They can't rape you if they can't see you. Way to go, Christopher Walken. Wait, fuck. No, I mean, forget it.
Well, this is a super lazy story. But then, because the sodomites didn't all invite the angels to dinner and a sleepover, Jehovah's having none of this. The angels tell Lot to get out of the city because God's going to nuke it, and not to look back at the city when it's nuked. But we know that when you tell a primitive person not to look directly at the sun during an eclipse, they absolutely fucking do, right? Right, Donald?
Oh my god, we better start packing because I think we're going to be getting deported soon.
Yeah, and there's apparently no problem with deporting people to countries they've never even been to.
Seems legit.
So Lot's wife, who doesn't get a name because women are only important in the Bible when they don't die, looks back and God gets salty.
Super salty.
Now, this story's stupidity has been analyzed by both biblical and secular historians as to its actual point. And nearly everyone agrees that the mob orgy has nothing to do with why Jehovah destroyed the city. There's a very fine point being made about how Abe showed hospitality to some angels and how Lot showed hospitality to angels.
With their non-digested food and their non-sleep-filled night.
The converse of that point is the inhospitality of the sodomites. Not only did they not invite angels to dinner and a slumber party, they threatened to violate them, which is just bad manners.
In some cultures, that's considered the polite thing to do.
And what cultures would those be?
I played the fifth.
No, like, I'm asking for a friend.
Oh, I got you. I'll hook you up later, bro.
Okay. So anyway, it's bad manners unless angels are into that sort of thing, in which case they probably would have asked Lot where the orgy was. But they didn't, so there's that. At no point does the mob say they want to specifically perform oral or anal sex with Christopher Walken.
Relatable.
And Eric Stoltz.
Oh my God, that reminds me of an episode of Rick and Morty where there's an alternate version of Morty called Eric Stoltz Mask Morty. Anyway, all of that is to say, Eric Stoltz with or without the mask, because definitely hard pass on the second one. No offense, Roy Dennis. Rest in peace, buddy.
I'm not sure. But the mob says they want to, quote, know them, which just means have sex with them. So it's vague at best.
Wait, is that not the best way to get to know someone?
I feel like you couldn't know someone more than to be inside them.
I want you inside me like a tapeworm.
But the overarching moral of this story is that when guests enter your city, you should treat them well. That's really it. And if that's it, then I agree that there were only four good people in the city. Jehovah was right. I mean, not about the nukes, but definitely about the inhospitality.
Not just nukes. Divine nukes. Those are even better than what Trump's got.
Oh no, we're gonna start a fight about the best divine nuke button or whatever.
I'm gonna nuke heaven.
The Christian interpretation of this story early on became a prohibition against sexual acts other than a man and a woman in the missionary position for purposes of procreation only.
Lights off, shirt on.
Right. When Islam was founded under various cultural influences, this interpretation was incorporated as well. In fact, the Quran uses the word liwat for anal intercourse, which translates to the sin of Lot's people. Apparently, it doesn't matter where you come from. If you can't read a story for what it is, you're bound to inject the same stupidity into it and propagate stupidity onto the third and fourth thousandth generation.
Are you Lot's wife? Because you sound salty as hell.
I am salty, but I'm not Lot's wife. There's a difference. Like, you can be one without being the other.
Not mutually exclusive.
Right. So the hadiths contain, much like blasphemy, prescriptions against non-procreative sex. This includes a married man having sex with his wife during her period, or a consenting married couple having anal sex, or two men having any kind of sex whatsoever.
And ear sex. Get your dicks out of people's ears, guys. Not cool.
What planet are you from?
The planet where people are experimenting with ear sex. Enough.
I feel like that's just asking for infections.
Feel like that's just asking to go deaf. Like, you're not even really supposed to put Q-tips in there, let alone
you
dicks.
Only swab the outer rim of the ear.
Whatever.
Just a rim job.
Oh God, we're done.
So, funnily enough, just like the Bible, there are no prohibitions against girl-on-girl action. Why? Probably because women don't matter. So saith the Lord, so saith we all. Amen.
Or because Yahweh has a very clear go-to when he opens up Pornhub. We all know what his browser history looks like.
I feel like we do. Anyway, since this became the official doctrine, and since religious zealots have controlled governments throughout history, laws were implemented all over the place, limiting the people with whom you could have sex and in what way.
No angels, no butt stuff.
Check.
Does this mean that Yahweh wasn't very fond of Zeus, the whole having sex with human women thing? Or did he just have a problem with the women that Zeus slept with? Was he like fist pounding Zeus and then turning around and scorning the women? Am I reading too far into this?
Yes.
Okay.
Given the ancient time period all of this arose, I'd assume that with various wars, plagues, and famines, there was a real concern over maintaining population growth.
Those pesky divine nukes.
Yeah, that too. Over time, and as secular sensibilities have gained footholds in government, these laws have been relaxed or abolished in more progressive societies. Nowadays, with 7 billion people on the planet and concerns over the availability of land, food, and natural resources.
Not trees, though. The J-Dubs used the last of those.
Correct. We really should encourage more oral and anal sex. I mean, why do we need more humans anyway? Everywhere I go is like an impossible obstacle course of human-sized traffic cones.
That's right. Enough of this silly procreation stuff.
Yeah. Insert plug for the voluntary human extinction movement.
Let's just get back to the ear sex.
Oh, God. I didn't know that's where that was going. Oh, so in the United States today, there are still sodomy laws that haven't been repealed or deleted, but they aren't enforceable. Federal law dictates that you can't send morality SWAT teams into people's private bedrooms and lock them up for having sex the wrong way.
Unless it's snuff sex. That's just terrible. Don't do that.
Why would you even mention that?
Because it exists and it's bad. Put an end to it. Let's go pick at snuff sex.
Okay. I feel like almost everyone universally is against that. Almost.
That's the thing, though, is that it's not everybody. It still happens.
Well, yeah, but, you know, there are still some people out there who aren't against eating turkey bacon either.
I mean, that's a totally different thing. I don't know why you're comparing the two.
I find it to be an abomination.
Oh, my God. Quote John, turkey bacon is bad as snuff sex.
It's not on the same level, but it's still terrible.
No, that's what I heard. That's what you said.
Oh, God. So I don't know exactly how you'd know the exact moment two people started 69ing anyway, unless you have cameras in everybody's houses linked to a central feed monitored 24/7.
I think that's called Pornhub.
Oh, shit. I knew I shouldn't podcast naked.
Actually, I doubt your feed gets any hits.
Rude. Maybe that's also why I haven't gotten any banner ad kickbacks. Pornhub.com/John.
Oh, God, no.
Anyway, to make the history of sodomy laws easier to swallow, we've called an expert to penetrate this legal morass.
Oh, my God.
You're welcome. I'm so happy to introduce our guest this week. She's the law-talking, joke-cracking, jingle-singing, deep-diving host of the Habeas Humor podcast who loves sodomy as much as the next heathen. We're talking to Sharon Frankel. How are you doing?
Hi. Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing very well. It's the new year. I'm trying to have a good mood for, you know, until something happens to spoil it. I know we won't be waiting long, but so far,
true that.
See, that positivity is just why I need to ask you. You seem way too funny and bubbly to be a lawyer. So is practicing law all work and no play?
You mean, does it make you crazy like in The Shining?
I guess, are you as likely to commit suicide as a dentist is what I'm saying.
Do they do that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that about dentists. I knew that doctors have a lot of suicide and drug abuse, and so do lawyers. Lawyers have terrible alcoholism statistics and drugs a lot. But yeah, I mean, it's lawyering. Lawyering, I think, is the technical term. It can really suck the life out of you, especially if you go to work for one of those places, like you guys know Andrew Torres of Opening Arguments. He, if you ask him why he left his big firm world, even though he was making buku bucks doing it, he'll say it was like, and I paraphrase, hopefully he, you know, and if he's correcting me, if he has corrections, he can send the complaints to @habeashumor on Twitter, as anyone can. I think what he said is that it kind of sucked his soul out of him because he wasn't doing satisfying work. He was having to put in tons and tons of hours and was being controlled by old men in their 80s who, you know, because men, especially men, women less so, but men in law tend to stay until they literally drop dead. I have replaced at least two dead guys, like literally when I have been at firms, like I'll get the dead guy's desk who died like last Friday and I come in on Monday because they just work until they die.
Do they leave angry ghosts behind?
I haven't encountered any, but I think it's kind of like it. At some point it consumes you. And I'm going to make an obscure nerdy reference here because I've just been watching this show called The Magicians on Netflix. I think it's a sci-fi series. And they have this thing where it's like if you do magic that's too powerful for you, it like consumes your body and you become this thing called a niffin, which is just like magical energy. So I think if you lawyer too long, you become like a lawyer niffin and it just consumes you and you just like stay there until you die. Other people leave, at least leave the grind kind of works behind them. Women tend to do that because they'll be like, screw this rat race. I'm going to go into raise my kids, you know. That is why you tend to see fewer old women practicing law than old men, I think.
Okay.
What was the question?
Well, I mean, I was going to ask you for a really awesome, like, lawyer ghost story, but I was wondering if, do you have, like, a funniest or a favorite story about being a lawyer?
Here's a funny story. This is from a long time ago when I was a law student in California, and I went with a lawyer who I was helping because I was still in school, so you can only, like, help other lawyers. You can't, like, practice law on your own. That would be irresponsible. So I drafted these motion papers, and then we went to argue the motion at the courthouse in Auburn, California, which is in the foothills of the Sierra Mountains. It's a very pretty little town, and I had never been to that courthouse before, and is a nice, pretty building. I think it was like a Victorian Gothic kind of architecture. I'm not a huge expert on the different kinds of Victorian architecture, but it looked, the building when we got there, I felt like I was in some kind of Hitchcock movie, because the setting there, like if this courthouse has not been used in some kind of film noir or something, shame on those people, because you pull up to this courthouse, it's like sitting on a hill. It's the highest building in the area. So it is, you know, looks like one of those scary houses from a horror film. And because it's the highest point, it's where all the birds roost. I think they were crows. So there were like a million crows on top of this horror movie house. And they were, because there were so many of them, there were birds at any given point in time, there was a bird taking off, flying around the building, and then landing somewhere else. So there was this constant swirl of birds around the building, constantly, just like a perpetual motion of crows flying around this, this like Victorian Gothic building.
Like carrion birds just waiting for dead meat to be wheeled out, right?
Maybe. Is that what crows are?
That was very specific.
Well, you know, that's the picture that I got in my head.
So yeah, I call this the Hitchcock, or like the birds courthouse or whatever, like the Hitchcock courthouse. And you can see, like when you're inside the courtroom, you can just see bird shit landing on the windows in like a stream.
Oh my gosh.
They must clean those like daily or something.
You'd think they'd have to.
Yeah. So the whole time we were sitting there, I was just like barely able to contain my giggling because I thought it was hilarious.
So can you be held in contempt for just giggling uncontrollably through a trial?
I mean, what would happen is like the judge would throw you out of the courtroom. But yeah, you could totally, like if you were someone essential to the case or something, you know, probably the judge would be like, do you need to get yourself together? And, you know, and like, but at some point, I mean, like you can totally, if you do anything the judge thinks is contemptuous, they can totally find you in contempt of court. Like in My Cousin Vinny, that was not unrealistic. There was very little in that film actually that was unrealistic. So
it's one of my favorite movies.
It's a great, great movie. Yeah.
So actually, on a quick side note, mm-hmm. what actually happens if you get thrown out of the courtroom? Like, does your defendant have to just defend themselves at that point?
Oh, or? You're the defendant's lawyer? Well, you know, you have to be careful. Like, a judge would know that the defendant at every point in the case has to have, cannot be deprived of their right to counsel. Otherwise, you're going to have an appeal. If the case comes out against the defendant, chances are it would be reversed on appeal. So yeah, I mean, if I don't know if it's ever happened where it's like a judge has been like, I cannot have this attorney in my courtroom.
Oh, I didn't realize that it was that outlandish. My bad.
Well, I mean, it's one thing to like throw someone out of the courtroom temporarily, like being like, hey, you're drunk. Like that happens on Law and Order all the time. It's probably happened in real life. Something like that, or you're not wearing good clothes.
A ridiculous tux.
Exactly. So, but like for a judge to be like, I cannot have this attorney in here ever. I hate this person. Like the judge might have to recuse themselves. I'll bet the judge would be swapped out before the attorney would be swapped out, unless the client fired the attorney, which is always a possibility. A client can always fire an attorney on the spot. So that would
do they
be
just get a new one?
Meyer. Yeah. Well, it's not always easy to get a new attorney. So these things get real complicated, actually. But yeah, so I was in that courtroom, like going hee hee hee, like trying to.
All right. So when we're talking about sodomy, we are talking about laws that affect people's private consensual behavior, like most commonly in the privacy of their own home. So mm-hmm. Why do you think that laws on the books like this can even stand for so long?
Well, I would say that, as we know from things as far back as Leviticus or even Genesis, the Judeo-Christian tradition has had a very disfavorable opinion of sex between two people of the same gender, especially when they're men. I mean, women weren't, I mean, like, I don't think they even thought about women because, like, women didn't matter. So it was, you know, but men, you know, it was not only a sin to have sex with another man, it was a sin to even masturbate, you know, waste your seed, onanism, all that shit. So that was taken as a given for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, that was the one of the most wrong things a person can do. Is, you know, men having sex with men. And our laws are for at least between like the year zero and the year 1900-ish, they are extremely inextricably intertwined with Christian tradition. And even though you see tons and tons of contradictions and inconsistencies if you compare the Ten Commandments with the U.S. Constitution, people have always had a sense of the fact that God's law informs human law. So the crazies like Roy Moore are not necessarily 100% wrong. They, you know, it's absolutely unconstitutional that they should be able to put up a monument of the Ten Commandments or whatever in any public building. But at the same time, people have thought that laws should match up with morality, and the majority of people have associated morality with religious morality, which is why you'll hear people say, well, where do you get your morality from if you don't believe in God? Like, to atheists like us, it's a no-brainer. It's like, well, I have an inherent sense of right or wrong because I understand what is bad behavior, so I don't do it. I understand what harms people, so I don't do it.
Right.
Period. The end. And yeah, so, but for people who are indoctrinated with religion, they don't think that way. They think, oh, I get it from the Bible because that's what I've been taught all my life, even though that's not even true. If you've been taught the Bible, like the real Bible, then you have probably been taught many times that, like, just because it says this here doesn't mean that you should apply that to your life. You know, you shouldn't necessarily take out someone's eye. You shouldn't necessarily, you know, there are all kinds of exceptions they have to make when they teach the Bible, if they teach the whole Bible, because there's so much non-morality in the Bible. Like, yeah, you shouldn't really rape people, you know?
Right. Well, and not only that, but there is a lot of context that goes along with it that seems to get ignored, where the law that was handed down in Leviticus or Exodus and Leviticus applied to the people of Israel and was not intended to apply to all people everywhere for all of time, especially since, you know, we have the concept of the New Testament and Jesus kind of like wiping the slate clean just a little bit here and there and all of that. But, you know, you're right that we do see a lot of religious influence in our laws. And obviously this, you know, sodomy laws are a very big example of that, because without any kind of religious influence or some sort of idea that somebody is offended by you not having sex in the missionary position all the time, you wouldn't come up with these laws in a secular society. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I was taught in college by a particular professor of cultural studies, and I don't know how popular that view is that he bestowed on us, but it makes a lot of sense to me, is that even religion aside, because oftentimes you can't, like, usually there's another reason than religion, because the Bible and everything is so inconsistent, there's usually another reason why people go with certain things, like accept certain things in the Bible, reject other things. Because as anyone knows, people are not consistent. They'll right. quote one part of Leviticus saying you can't have gay marriage or gay sex, but then they'll be like, tattoos are fine, pork is fine, all that shit. So there's usually another reason. And the other reason that I was taught was that conservatives in society are very invested in propagating the belief that sex cannot be for pleasure. Sex has to be just for procreation, at least officially. Like, everyone knows that people break those rules, but you have to at least officially say that sex is for reproduction and not for pleasure.
Right.
And in a committed marriage. And when a society decides that it is okay for people of the same sex to engage in sex, there's no getting around the fact that they're only doing that for pleasure and not for reproduction. So it's an acknowledgement that sex can be for pleasure alone. And that can be very dangerous to the social structure, because our social structure is based on a long-held tradition of people getting married and then committing to one person and to only have sex in that marital relationship and only for reproduction. And that way, families are defined. You know whose children belong to whom, and that way you keep family units. And family units are like the fundamental unit of social control, because when families are cohesive, they keep order, they keep control, because no one has more control over you than your own family.
Right. Well, and it also seems like, you know, if you're going to try and find a non-religious argument against sex outside of marriage or sodomy, in any context, then one of the most obvious reasons for opposing sodomy and legislating against it would be because people think it's yucky. And I think that a lot of the little, or not little, but a lot of the social battles that we have in this country come from people not being able to defend a religious proscription against something that, you know, two consensual people can do and be completely fine with. So they have to resort to, well, I just think it's gross, so it should be illegal.
Yep.
So part of that is just kind of a puritanical mentality that we've seen change over time. And I think we're becoming a lot more progressive as a society, even though we just have big blocks that kind of try to anchor us back in, say, the 1500s. Which brings me to the laws that we've inherited from England, like the Buggery Act of 1533, which is a hilarious name.
It is. And I also love the fact that because, you know, old timey spelling was different, they spelled it B-U-G-G-E-R-I-E, according to Wikipedia.
That makes it even better.
Yes. And there's a citation, opening arguments, people, 25 Henry VIII, C6.
This one was pretty good.
Right. And I Wikipedia'd this. So, and because I was wondering, like, why at this point in time and everything. And Henry, like, English history is one of my things that I do, like, as a hobby. So, and especially anything to do with the Tudors. So, and Henry VIII is, of course, very fascinating. So anytime you think laws passed during the lifetime of Henry VIII by his regime, chances are it has something to do with Protestant Reformation or religious reform, because Henry VIII was the English monarch that broke away from the Catholic Church. And it was for many reasons. I mean, people oversimplify it as saying it was so that he could marry Anne Boleyn and divorce Catherine of Aragon, but that's not the whole truth.
Okay.
But it looks like, I mean, according to Wikipedia, the act was piloted through Parliament by Henry VIII's minister Thomas Cromwell, and punish the detestable and abominable vice of buggery committed with mankind or beast.
And that part of it, I completely agree with. This podcast does not promote or condone bestiality.
Don't take bestiality.
Don't take bestiality advice from a podcast.
Although, take this. I also am against buggery with beasts. Absolutely.
All right. We're on the same page.
Yeah. No. No, I was trying to make the joke, but the joke doesn't really work because, I think all of us are in consensus that, don't have sex with animals. I mean, except for human people or animals, blah, blah, blah. But
no, yeah, but we are animals that can consent. And that's the important animals. Part.
So Thomas Cromwell, right? Thomas Cromwell was a religious reformer. He was the guy who came after Thomas More as, like, Henry VIII's right-hand man, because Thomas More was a Catholic, and Henry VIII eventually had him executed because he would not renounce Catherine of Aragon as the queen, et cetera, et cetera. And Thomas More, because he was a Catholic, he was not okay with that, and he remained unokay with it, even as it cost him his head. So Thomas Cromwell, on the other hand, was a reformer, and he was, I think at the time, it was kind of loosely defined, there were Lollards, there were people who were following Martin Luther, kind of, but I don't think they would call themselves Lutherans. But anyway, Thomas Cromwell was a guy that was also wanting to be apart from the Catholic Church. And so was Henry VIII by that time. Henry VIII was now the head of the Church of England. And he now had to make, like, the laws for what, you know, now he was the church and the state, and they were one and the same. And he had to make laws for how people are going to behave and how things are going to be punished. So I think this was part of the body of laws that he made so that there would be things on the book. because they were no longer following the Pope's ecclesiastical law. And then when Henry VIII's daughter, Mary, ascended to the throne, she repealed this because she said, no, this should be a matter for the ecclesiastical courts in Rome. So this was like a very Protestant kind of law, because it was saying that we should handle this in our state courts, not in religious courts.
Right. And it gave you the ability for the state to exercise power over the people and to make public examples of people who were deemed deviant or sinful.
Sure.
Okay. So we came over to America and we had these sensibilities just kind of ingrained in us. So we sort of brought them with us. And for hundreds of years, we let these things stand. But then there was a landmark federal case that invalidated a lot of state sodomy laws, not including bestiality. And that is Lawrence v. Texas. So what do we know about that?
Well, you are absolutely right. In order to talk about Lawrence v. Texas, you actually first have to talk about the 1986 case of Bowers versus Hardwick. I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
I found that one in my research.
Okay. So that case was, like I said, 1986. And it was, what happened was that there was a guy named Michael Hardwick in Georgia. He was in his own house, in his own bedroom, having sex with another dude. And a police officer came in and saw them. And I'm uncertain on the facts of like how or why that cop was there.
Right.
Apparently he was there for some legal reason. Like something happened that made him want to take Hardwick in for violating Georgia anti-sodomy laws. I mean, they probably were not enforced very much. It could be like that cop was trying to nail Hardwick for some other crime. And this was something he could use for leverage. You know, like you see on Law and Order, it's like they're after somebody for murder, but they don't have the evidence on that. So they nail them for something else, you know?
Right.
And so they're like, oh, I'll charge you with this if you don't cooperate, that kind of thing. So Hardwick sued the state in federal court because there was a law in Georgia at the time that said a person commits the offense of sodomy when he performs or submits to any sexual act involving the sex organs of one person and the mouth or anus of another. And you can get up to 20 years for that.
Okay. I think that a lot of us would be in trouble right now.
Well, and that's a good point, because it doesn't say anything about being gay, does it?
No.
It applies to everybody. So that was the law in Georgia. And many states had similar laws. And so this guy Hardwick was arrested for violating that. So he said, you know, this seems unconstitutional. I'm going to file a case in federal court and try to have this law struck down as unconstitutional. And so he asserted that the law violated various amendments of the Constitution. First Amendment, because the court had decided in 1969, the Supreme Court had decided in 1969 that people have a First Amendment right to read or watch porn in their homes. So he was arguing that they should have the same right to have oral or anal sex in their homes.
Okay.
A privacy related to free speech thing, because there's no privacy. There's nothing in the Constitution that says privacy. So privacy has to be inferred through like free speech or life, liberty, property, that kind of thing.
Okay.
He also said, as stated in the Fifth and 14th Amendments, people have the right to life, liberty, and property. So that liberty should include sex with whomever.
Agreed.
Yeah. So in this case, the majority of justices on the Supreme Court decided against Hardwick. They decided that the law was constitutional. And Georgia has the right to outlaw oral and anal sex if they want to. What they said in the majority opinion was written by Justice White, and he was joined by Justice Berger, Powell, Rehnquist, and O'Connor. So what the majority opinion says is that this case does not require a judgment on whether laws against sodomy between consenting adults in general or between homosexuals in particular are wise or desirable. It raises no question about the right or propriety of state legislative decisions to repeal their laws that criminalize homosexual sodomy, or of state court decisions invalidating those laws on state constitutional grounds. The issue presented, as the majority opinion frames it, is whether the federal constitution confers a fundamental right upon homosexuals to engage in sodomy, and hence invalidates the laws of many states that still make such conduct illegal and have done so for a very long time.
So that sounds like what it's saying is, unless you have something in the Constitution saying it is okay to be a homosexual and have sex, then it's totally fine for states to outlaw your personal consensual behavior in private.
Exactly. And that, you know, that framing of it is criticized by the dissenters. So it was good that you picked up on that, because the way that, because you could frame this issue in different ways. And the way that the court was doing it in order to get the result they wanted was to say, well, this is all, this is about, this case is about, do people have a fundamental right to sodomy? Or, you know, do homosexuals have a fundamental right to sodomy? Because I don't think they even went into whether whether straight couples can do it. I read the opinion. I didn't scrutinize every piece of it because I was trying to pull highlights. So they may have gone into that, but, you know, and Hardwick for his side was trying to compare this case to cases on birth control, abortion, you know, intermarriage, because the Supreme Court had already ruled that people have a fundamental right to do any of those things. And so what White and the majority says is no connection between family, marriage, or procreation on the one hand, and homosexual activity on the other hand has been demonstrated in this case. And for all the ass covering they do about talking about how they're not just trying to superimpose ancient morality on the current law, they bring it up a lot. Like they're saying prescriptions against that conduct have ancient roots.
Right.
Therefore, the Constitution should not be interpreted to confer the right to sodomy, because they're saying, like, well, you know, if sodomy was illegal in the time of the founding fathers, then how could they have intended that that would be a right in the Constitution? And the law is constantly based on notions of morality. And if all laws representing essentially moral choices are to be invalidated under the Due Process Clause, the courts will be very busy indeed. Which I agree. Like, yeah, they would be very busy, but you know what? That's a good thing, because there's a lot of laws on the books that come from just Christian religious bullshit, mostly Christian, because of the way that this country is. And yeah, they should be challenged in the courts. I'm guessing you would agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, anything like mixing prayer in schools and that kind of shit, you know?
Right. And also just kind of what this sounds like is making arguments from tradition and saying that, well, you know, if it's been this way for this amount of time, then there's no reason why it shouldn't just always be that way, because that's how we've always done it. And it's not like it was killing anybody before, which is fairly naive.
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, they definitely, one thing that judges consider in making legal decisions is what we would call policy questions. So, like, is this good for society? And it certainly seems like these people had an undercurrent in their mind of this not being okay. I mean, I don't know that they wrote anything so explicit, but that's really the tradition of conservative judges as we tend to understand them. You know, when people who are more constitutional scholars, you know, they read decision after decision, they kind of form a profile of what these justices believe. And as we know, like, Republican appointees tend to believe that gay marriage is not okay, especially in the 80s. Gay sex is not okay. A lot of them are not even okay on abortion. So,
right. Or, I mean, even when you get right down to it, sex outside of marriage,
mm-hmm.
and any number of just weird, silly, religiously informed kind of opinions or worldviews. So I guess
exactly.
What it sounds like is that our big problem is that we have humans on the Supreme Court that hold worldviews and can't see outside of them.
Holy shit. We need to replace all the Supreme Court judges with robots.
Exactly.
Exactly. We need robot Supreme Court.
RoboCourt. That should be the sequel to RoboCop.
It should, because the cop will arrest them, and then RoboCourt will sentence
them. That's amazing. This is one reboot that I'm totally down for.
All right.
Yeah. Let's write it. Copyrighted. No one steal it.
Let's do this. We need to trademark it, like, right now.
Trademark. Okay. I think it's funny.
I think it's funny that the lawyer just verbally copywrote something.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. It's like declaring bankruptcy, right? Okay.
So there were two dissenting opinions. One was by Blackmun, and he very famously says in that opinion, it is improper for the majority to frame the issue in the case as a fundamental right to engage in sodomy. We already kind of went over that. And he says this case is no more about a fundamental right to engage in homosexual sodomy, as the court purports to declare, Rather, it is about the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized men, namely the right to be let alone.
Okay.
He quotes Roe versus Wade, which says that it is revolting to have no better reason for a rule of law than so it was laid down in the time of Henry IV. He's even further back than Henry VIII there.
Wow.
it goes back to Henry IV. So, still more revolting if the grounds upon which it was laid down have vanished long since and the rule simply persists from blind imitation of the past, as you guys were saying.
Argument from tradition.
Exactly.
Okay.
And only the most willful blindness, so he's accusing the majority of being like willfully blind, could obscure the fact that sexual intimacy is a sensitive key relationship of human existence, central to family life, community welfare, and the development of human personality. The court's failure to comprehend the magnitude of the liberty interests at stake in this case leads it to slight the question of whether the state of Georgia has justified their infringement on those interests. And he further says, a state can no more punish private behavior because of religious intolerance than it can punish such behavior because of racial animus. So he's saying if you can't do it to Black people, you know, if you can't do something because of racism, you shouldn't be able to do it for your, you know, because of your religious beliefs, which a lot of us are like, yeah, fuck yeah. Like Masterpiece Cake Bakery, hate bakery, whatever the fuck.
Yes, the hate bakery.
Yeah. So that's how the court used to be. At least, you know, the sensible people on the court were like, yeah, racism and like religious intolerance, same difference.
Right. And this does seem like, and, you know, we are talking about the defendant being a homosexual man. And when we are talking about, you know, the kinds of bigotry and the laws that are directed, clearly directed at homosexual members of the community, then we are talking about the same types of situations that were set up with Jim Crow laws and all of that, that just codified racism for the entire country. And it's, mm-hmm. it's very strange to me that we went through the civil rights movement, and we're definitely not any post-racial society. There are tons and tons of issues outstanding. But having gone through this, the civil rights movement, and having all of this basis for saying, look, just because somebody is a different color, a different race, or from a different country than you, like you can't discriminate against them and treat them like they're not human. Why can't, like, I just don't understand why people can't draw the parallels and be like, okay, this person doesn't live their life the same way as you. They're homosexual, you're heterosexual, but that doesn't matter. You're both citizens, you're both human, and you both deserve exactly the same rights.
Right.
So that just gets me all the time. I'm like, what the hell?
Well, there are still a lot of people that think that gay people should be put to death.
Yeah.
And so should women who get abortions, you know?
Yep.
But then we also need to talk about the Stevens dissent because it gets directly quoted in the case that overturns this case.
Okay.
So Justice John Paul Stevens, as I have said on my show, he is my favorite Supreme Court justice. I think he's a genius. I think he says things that just put, like, just completely say it all, you know. So he talks about prior cases such as Roe versus Wade and all those things. He says that they make two propositions abundantly clear. First, the fact that the governing majority in a state has traditionally viewed a particular practice as immoral is not a sufficient reason for upholding a law prohibiting the practice. Neither history nor tradition could save a law prohibiting miscegenation from constitutional attack. That means intermarriage between Black and white people.
Okay.
Because that used to be illegal until Loving versus Virginia.
Correct.
And second, individual decisions by married persons concerning the intimacies of their physical relationship, even when not intended to produce offspring, are a form of liberty protected by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And they are talking, he's citing to Griswold versus Connecticut. And one thing that people who listen to your show may or may not know is that it used to be illegal for even married people to use condoms.
Oh.
Because that's not sex for procreation. That's sex for pleasure.
Well, that's
and that's wrong.
Catholic prohibition.
Exactly. So the evolution of birth control becoming legal, or even condoms, let alone birth control, like birth control pills, is like, first it was allowed for married people. Then it had to be decided could unmarried people use condoms, because that was all like a whole different issue, you know? So it was a while before, like, because certain states would say, no condoms for you.
Right.
Okay. So there was a Connecticut law at the time that criminalized the provision of counseling and other medical treatment to married persons for purposes of preventing contraception. So Yeah, that was what they challenged, that even married people couldn't practice contraception.
Okay.
So Stephen says about that, just because the governing majority in a state has traditionally viewed that practice as immoral is not sufficient reason for upholding the law if it's in violation of the Constitution. Although the meaning of the principle that all men are created equal is not always clear. No shit. It implies sexism right in there.
Absolutely.
It surely must mean that every free citizen, so, you know, slaves not included.
Correct.
He's saying this in 1980, like the 1980s, has the same interest in liberty that the members of the majority share. From the standpoint of the individual, the homosexual and the heterosexual have the same interest in deciding how he will live his own life. Again, women don't matter. And more narrowly, how he will conduct himself in his personal and voluntary associations. And state intrusion into the private conduct of either is equally burdensome.
Well, and everything in that just makes sense on its face. Mm-hmm. And what I don't understand, I guess, is when you are talking about more conservative judges who presumably, like the conservative voters, would think that government intrusion into your life or big government control of your life is a bad thing. It just strikes me as very odd that these justices would be like, no, it's okay for us to make laws that tell you what you can and can't do in your bedroom.
Absolutely.
You know, because it seems like those justices would be like the ones that would say, no, big government is bad. We shouldn't be legislating every little thing that a person does. This law is garbage. Let's get rid of it.
Oh, you mean like people who are conservative and libertarian don't think that there should be big government, and yet they want the government to, you know, get into my uterus and shit? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Get into my uterus.
Get all up in there. In my
uterus. As like the fat bastard.
In my uterus.
I want my baby back. So, the other thing that Steven says is he talks about how it violates equal protection because Georgia doesn't prosecute straight couples for this. They only prosecute gay couples for this. So when you have selective application, that has to be supported by a neutral and legitimate interest, something more substantial than a habitual dislike for or ignorance about the disfavored group. And the state has not identified any such interest in this case other than just, homophobia. So he says it's unconstitutional on equal protection grounds as well. So fast forward to 2003. Notice we are like 15-ish years after Bowers versus Hardwick.
Yeah, that's a really long time.
No, it's a very short time. As far as Supreme Court time, it's very short because the Supreme Court does not like to reverse itself. Our whole system of common law, common law is not just like common law marriage. Common law is our whole system where we follow precedents in the court. And we call that stare decisis, as you would know probably from listening to opening arguments. So that stare decisis is Latin for stand by precedent. So it's very important in our legal tradition that we stand by precedent, that we, like, even if we maybe disagree a little bit with a prior court decision, unless there's like a huge reason to overturn it, we stay with it because stability is kind of key to this system. Just having laws being overturned willy-nilly means there's no predictability. You know, there's like, we can't know what the law is because it's changing every 5 minutes.
Right.
So, like, for example, Plessy versus Ferguson from 1890, the case where separate but equal was determined to be okay, it was 60 plus years before the Supreme Court decided Brown versus Board of Education, where they were like, no, separate but equal, not okay. So that's how often they usually overrule themselves on these things.
Okay. I guess I was just thinking from like the amount of time that it takes for social change, like 15 years on whether it's okay for you to just have sex with somebody seems like a really long time to wait for something to come around.
Like 2,000 years.
Well, yeah. So yeah, there's that.
But yeah, it's important to note that this case came less than like 15 years after Bowers, because like I said, it's kind of unprecedented for the Supreme Court to reverse itself that soon.
Okay.
So in the Lawrence versus Texas case, that was decided in 2003. And the facts were that there was police who were responding to a weapons disturbance in a private residence in Houston. So they go into this guy, John Lawrence's apartment, and they see him and another guy having sex. So they were arrested under a statute in Texas that forbids two people of the same sex to engage in sex. So they arrested them for that. And then so those people challenged the constitutionality of that Texas law. Now, of course, we see a difference here. This law outlaws gay sex. It doesn't say anything about straight people doing oral or anal.
Okay.
So this time the court decides that the sodomy law is unconstitutional. And the reasoning that they use is that there should not be any kind of laws of this kind. So that basically struck down every sodomy law in the United States, even though you will see them still on the books, because every time the Supreme Court, like every time a court makes a decision that a certain law was unconstitutional, it doesn't get like automatically deleted from the law. Someone has to, you know, the legislature would have to go and repeal it. And usually, you know, they don't bother.
Right.
So the opinion was by Kennedy, and he was joined by Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. They say that Stevens was absolutely right back in Bowers versus Hardwick. His opinion should have been the majority opinion. He was right. The Bowers versus Hardwick majority was wrong, and we should adopt his reasoning in this case and overrule Bowers versus Hardwick.
Okay, and the operative concept in this overturning was the Due Process Clause?
Yes, the Due Process Clause, specifically the right to life, liberty, and property that should not be taken away without due process of law. There are two kinds of due process analysis that have been kind of developed throughout the 20th century by the Supreme Court. There's substantive due process, and then there's procedural due process. So substantive due process determines whether something is a fundamental right of people.
Okay.
And that's the liberty part. And if something is a fundamental right of people, then it cannot be taken away without a law that meets the strict scrutiny standard, which means compelling state interest and least restrictive means.
Okay. And then it also means that if the liberty is applied to a person, then it is applied to all people, right?
That would be equal protection, which is also in the 14th Amendment.
Okay.
So what Kennedy says in this opinion is that he says it was not until the 70s that any state singled out same-sex relationships for criminal prosecution, and only 9 states have done so. Arkansas, Kansas, Kentucky, Missouri, Montana, Nevada, Tennessee, Texas, and Oklahoma. Kennedy gets a little defensive here about the Bowers decision. Don't kill us about the Bowers. He goes, it must be acknowledged, of course, that the court in Bowers was making the broader point that for centuries there have been powerful voices to condemn homosexual conduct as immoral, and the condemnation has been shaped by religious beliefs, conceptions of right and acceptable behavior, and respect for the traditional family. And for many persons, these are not trivial concerns, but profound and deep convictions accepted as ethical and moral principles, yet because of their stupid Bible. And I added that part myself.
No, I think that should have been part of it, though.
Exactly. Yeah, I think they absolutely should have me write their opinions. And then he talks about the doctrine of stare decisis, because he acknowledges like this is, in Supreme Court time, a very fast overruling of the Bowers case. So he says the doctrine of stare decisis is essential to the respect accorded to the judgments of the court and to the stability of the law. It is not, however, an inexorable command. Rather, it is a principle of policy and not a mechanical formula of adherence to the latest decision. And he refers to Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was an abortion case that came after Roe versus Wade. We noted that when a court is asked to overrule a precedent recognizing a constitutional liberty interest, individual or societal reliance on the existence of that liberty cautions with particular strength against reversing course. The holding in Bowers, however, has not induced detrimental reliance comparable to some instances where recognized individual rights are involved.
So going back to My Cousin Vinny, essentially what this is saying is everything that guy just said is bullshit.
Yes, in a way. And also they're saying that like nobody is harmed by us reversing this. Like no one has like had lots of gay sex in reliance or anything like that. So Bowers itself causes uncertainty, the majority says, for the precedents before and after its issuance contradict its central holding. He's saying that Bowers was inconsistent with other Supreme Court decisions talking about fundamental rights. So therefore, it actually was the problem with consistency, not the present case that's going to reverse it. Then they quote Justice Stevens's dissent in Bowers. They say the rationale of Bowers does not withstand careful analysis. In his dissenting opinion in Bowers, Justice Stevens came to these conclusions. And he says, our prior cases make two propositions abundantly clear. And he means the Supreme Court's prior cases like Roe versus Wade, etc. First, the fact that the governing majority in a state has traditionally viewed a particular practice as immoral is not a sufficient reason for upholding the law. We already even said that. neither history nor tradition could save a law prohibiting miscegenation. We already went over that. And individual decisions by married persons concerning the intimacies of the physical relationship, even when not pretended to induce offspring, are a form of liberty protected by due process, as in Griswold versus Connecticut. So those were the points of Stevens's dissent that I read before. So that's what is being brought up now by the majority in Lawrence versus Texas. And so they say that Bowers was not correct when it was decided. It is not correct today. It ought not to remain binding precedent. Bowers versus Hardwick should be and is now overruled. So they explicitly say that so that there's no ambiguity.
Awesome.
Interestingly, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote a concurring opinion. So she actually did not think that Bowers versus Hardwick should be overruled. She thought that it is okay to have sodomy laws as long as they apply to everybody. She thought that this Texas law should be struck down because of the fact that it discriminates against gay people. So she only bought the equal protection argument. She didn't buy the due process argument.
Okay.
And most fun is the dissent by Justice Scalia. Because the three justices who were against striking down the Texas law were Scalia, Rehnquist, and Thomas.
Of course.
Of course. Scalia has a vitriolic dissent in this case. He is beyond upset that the Supreme Court has reversed Bowers versus Hardwick in 15 years because they have been refusing to revisit the issue of abortion ever since the 70s.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. He's like, you assholes, you keep telling me we can't revisit abortion because we have to leave the precedent alone. So he was really, really upset about this case.
So he's essentially rolling around on the floor, throwing a tantrum because he hasn't gotten his way.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes.
It seems like such a dignified way for a Supreme Court justice to behave.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you go back and look at the way Scalia has has behaved during his life, it's he's kind of the Trump of the Supreme Court.
Yeah. You don't get too many surprised faces when somebody says Scalia did this. And now we have young, healthy Scalia on the Supreme Court, which is fantastic.
Yes. Oh, great. Yeah. Young Scalia. Scalia 2.0. Gorsuch. Yeah. So Justice Scalia's dissent, and I will give you guys the links. So what Scalia starts off with in his dissent is he cites to Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was from 1992, and the quotation there that says, liberty finds no refuge in a jurisprudence of doubt. That was the court's sententious response. Sententious, just dictionary definition. Given to moralizing in a pompous or affected manner.
Oh, so they were being uppity.
Mm. So that was the court's sententious response barely more than a decade ago to those seeking to overrule Roe versus Wade. The court's response today to those who have engaged in a 17-year crusade to overrule Bowers versus Hardwick is very different. The need for stability and certainty presents no barrier. Like, I'm giving the inflection that he must have had. He's saying that they're assholes because they were being sententious when Planned Parenthood versus Casey was asking them to overturn Roe versus Wade. They were like, no, we need to stand by precedent. But now, precedent schmecedent for Bowers versus Hardwick. So that it goes on like that. What a massive disruption of the current social order the overruling of Bowers entails. Not so the overruling of Roe, which would simply have restored the regime that existed for centuries before 1973, in which the permissibility of and restrictions upon abortion were determined legislatively state by state.
Oh, it's a state's rights argument.
Well, as far as abortion, like the issue in Roe was like, should states have the right to outlaw abortion? And the Supreme Court said no, because the U.S. Constitution guarantees women the right to terminate a pregnancy at least in the first trimester. But he's saying that this decision overruling Bowers and you know, striking down sodomy laws is a massive disruption of the current social order.
Which is really, it's so strange. It's like saying, no, if we take rights, reproductive rights away from women and make them just third party onlookers onto their own bodily autonomy, then that's really not affecting anybody. But if we allow homosexuals to have sex, then that is just going to destroy civilization as we know it.
Right.
That's amazing.
Well, what do we know? Women don't matter.
Yeah. Well, it becomes more and more clear every time a conservative opens their mouth.
Exactly.
All right. So,
yeah.
So now that we have invalidated sodomy laws, the states that still have them obviously cannot enforce them. And so these laws are just kind of hanging around because nobody wants to put the effort into specifically erasing them.
Right.
So, I mean, what are the chances that there are some MAGA legislators out there who actually enjoy that these laws haven't been stricken from the books just in case we can revisit this someday?
I'm sure that the states that had these, you know, if they had really believed in the Lawrence decision, they probably would have struck them as like a symbolic thing.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, probably the people in those states still, I mean, those states that I named, what, Oklahoma, Kentucky, all those are the states that probably still disapprove of gay people.
Right. Yep.
Majority.
All right.
Majority.
Well, that was a good walkthrough, very informative and very serious. So I kind of wanted to get a little lighthearted and ask you, as a funny thought experiment, what consensual act should nevertheless have laws against it?
Wow, it's hard to narrow that down. As any New Yorker could tell you, it should be punishable by caning for people to walk in the middle of the sidewalk if there's two or more of them. And if they hold hands, they should have those hands chopped off with the Saudi hand chopper offer machine.
Hand chopper offer machine.
Yeah.
I believe that's the technical term.
I want that's one.
A technical term. I don't know what the Arabic is. If someone could write in.
Yeah. No, we just translated it. It's okay. So then in the same vein as that, what consensual act should have laws requiring it?
Ooh.
Using your fucking turn signal.
Oh my God, yes.
Wait, that's already the law.
I do believe that's already the law.
You would think, but apparently half of the world's population hasn't gotten that goddamn memo.
Yeah, it almost seems like there are a bunch of people driving around with cars that never had turn signals installed in the first place, or at least
that car manufacturers are going about things, maybe that's a package that you need to get additionally added onto your car. Oh, yeah, this is the legal package. It's $5,000 extra dollars.
I think, and this is my most definite unconcealable bias as a straight woman. If a guy says that he's going to call you, he has to call you.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, no, I think that that's right.
I mean, that's just being a gentleman, let's be honest.
Well, yeah. It's just being a reasonable human being. Like, don't tell somebody you're going to do something and then don't do it. That's bullshit.
Yeah, don't ghost on people. Like, you know, like, especially it should be like a time consideration, just the same with abortion. Like, you have first trimester, second trimester, like, depending on how many dates you've had, is it okay to like to break up with someone by text? Or is it okay to just ghost? You know, I would say like one or two dates, it's okay to break up with someone by text, but you should have the courtesy to at least let them know.
Okay. So now we have the expert legal opinion of a lawyer talking about whether it's okay to break up with someone by text or not.
Exactly. Don't take dating advice from Sharon, by the way. I'm single at 40.
Oh, no.
Oh, man.
Oh.
I have three cats.
Well, you know what? I'll bet your cats absolutely love you because I think that you are so much fun. And
oh, thank you.
I just really want to thank you for hanging out with us today. Well, why don't you tell us everywhere that our listeners can find you and we can link in the show notes.
Great. Well, I will send you the links. I am on Twitter at Habeas Humor, HABEASHUMOR. My homepage for the podcast on Libsyn is HABEASHUMOR.libsyn.com. And I'm on Facebook too, Habeas Humor.
All right. Well, we will get those linked in the show notes. And I am just so happy that you came on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess you weren't the worst guest we've ever had.
Whatever.
Mario Kart 8!
What are you buying?
Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's gonna die. Come watch TV.
Teach me.
No.
All right, ladies and gents, it's time for my favorite segment. And for clarification purposes, I don't know if we actually mentioned this in the last episode, but this intentionally has absolutely nothing to do with what we talked about at all in the episode.
Kind of a break from the mind-numbing weirdness of religion.
Yeah, and we hope you appreciate that. But if you don't, Pete, go die.
That was, again, oddly specific.
It's a meta joke, trust me. All right, so the topic of this week's pop segment, keeping with the video game theme for now, is idle games.
What even is an idle game?
Something that you apparently hate incredibly. Almost as much as turkey bacon and snuff sex.
And new console controllers.
Yeah, that too. So, idle games, I think almost synonymously also referred to as incremental games, are primarily computer and mobile based. Idle or incremental games are games where you start out with either no resources or very few resources, and you essentially manually build up a small stock of those resources and then use those resources to purchase things that will harvest that resource for you.
What would these resources be?
I'm making it as vague as possible because that's like the most vague description I can give of idle games. But that leads me to the godfather of idle games, and that is Cookie Clicker. This indie game developer named Ortil, he and his buddy have this site called Dashnet, and they basically make all sorts of silly games. But Ortil made Cookie Clicker, and basically this is a game where you have a giant cookie on one side of the screen and a bunch of like things that you can purchase on the other side of the screen with cookies. So you click on the cookie a bunch of times and you get a bunch of cookies, and then you spend those cookies on things that make cookies for you.
I feel like a cookie-based economy would not be a bad thing.
It definitely wouldn't, although I feel like it wouldn't be a very like stable economy because people would just be eating their money all the time.
But you can just make more money.
I guess you could. Ironically enough, they're like little news tickers that scroll over at the top of Cookie Clicker, and the lore behind it is that like eventually you make enough cookies that the world's economy starts running off of cookies.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So you start making a bunch of cookies, and you buy grandmas to make cookies for you, and then you make cookie farms, and then you make cookie mines and cookie factories, and then you get upgrades for it. So Ordeal made this game where he thought, like, he literally made this game as a joke, and he thought that people would play for like 15 seconds and then put it down because it was just nothing, and he was just like, oh, whatever, this is something stupid that I made.
Seems like a reasonable assumption.
Yeah, but it turns out that people just got hooked, and they were playing that game nonstop. And I actually remember when I first found out what Cookie Clicker was, it was like my friend in high school was just like, hey, have you guys heard of Cookie Clicker? It's so stupid, play it. And then I played it for like 5 months and lost 5 months of my life because I was just addicted to clicking on cookies and getting things to click cookies for me.
That really just seems like par for you.
That's my life. My life is sad, let's be honest. So anyway, yeah, so we made it as a joke, and then it caught on like big time. Like people all over the world were playing Cookie Clicker for some reason. And he was like, what the fuck is happening? But then like instantaneously, all of these PIB games came out. So I use the term PIB games because it's like somebody made an original game concept, and that would be like Dr. Pepper. And then like all these other people made the same exact game clone. And that's like the Mr. PIB version of Dr. Pepper.
Or like Dr. Thunder.
Or I just went to Aldi and there was one called Dr. Dazzle.
I actually like that one. I'm going to have to pick up a case.
They didn't have Diet Dr. Dazzle though, so be prepared for that.
Oh, sad panda.
So yeah, Cookie Clicker came out and it caught on big time. And all of these other game devs were like, whoa, why did we never think about this before? This is such a stupidly easy game to make, and we can monetize it and make oodles of money off of it. So yeah, all of these PIB versions of Cookie Clicker came out. There was one that was called Cookies Clicker, and there was one that was called Cookie Clonkers, and just all sorts of stupid stuff. And
clever.
Yeah, they were mostly mobile games that people were like putting ads in and like having you buy microtransactions so that they could make money off of it. The exact reason that PIB games exist, because people are just like, oh, that's a good way to make money. I'm going to do that too. So anyway, after all these PIB versions of Cookie Clicker came out, people were actually like, hey, this is actually kind of a cool game genre. I'm going to get in on this action. And they did. Basically, like, Cookie Clicker was the birth of the entire idle game genre.
I kind of want to dispute that just a little bit, because back in, oh, geez, like 2001, maybe, there was a game that came out that was just a very simple little UI that had a bunch of text boxes on it. And it was called, I don't remember if it was called
Candy
like,
Box.
No, Adventure Quest or something like that. And essentially it was, you had this team, it wasn't graphical at all. So you had this team of adventurers and they were out exploring and they would encounter enemies and they would battle them and they would either win or lose. But then like all of these little stat boxes would just continually change and you rarely interacted with them, but you could like click little buttons to like kind of speed it up or whatever. But essentially it was just this game that you fired up on your computer and you just let it run and it just did its thing. And then like you got onto leaderboards the longer that you had it running, even if you didn't do anything at all.
Why have I never heard of this before?
I don't know. I'm gonna have to look it up.
Okay. Well, all right. Seeing as how I've never heard of that, and I feel like the bulk of the internet doesn't know what that is, it is arguably considered the birth of the idle game genre, because it definitely wasn't mainstream before this. So, yeah, Cookie Clicker came out, all these PIB versions came out, and then it basically just, like, really took off. People started publishing idle games left and right, and to this day, there are still a lot of idle games, including Cookie Clicker, that are still, like, supported with updates. Like, people just keep cramming more content into their idle games, because, like, a lot of people would argue that idle games don't have a point because there's no way to win. Like, you just keep going until you decide that you've had enough of it, pretty much.
Right.
And that's, for the most part, true. But then people who made idle games started incorporating what's called a prestiging system, which, in all honesty, is just another way to prolong the inevitable running out of steam, basically. But it gives you some sort of purpose. So in Cookie Clicker, at least, when you get to a certain amount of cookies, you can prestige. And when you prestige, you basically give up your entire collection of cookies and all of the upgrades and stuff that you've purchased, and you reset yourself at square one. But the catch is that you get ascension upgrades, and in Cookie Clicker, they're called heavenly chips. But the vague, whatever you want to call, like, template version of that for any other idle game would just be like some sort of prestiging currency.
I just remembered about that platypus game. One, it was almost identical to Cookie Clicker, but it was all platypuses. And eventually you'd get a platypus that was like as big as the universe. And then you could reset it and start over with just like one tiny little platypus.
Oh, like the evolution game where you like dragged platypi on top of each other and they evolved?
Yeah.
I don't think that that's really considered an idle game, but that is a good example of prestiging, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, you got this prestige system where you basically reset yourself back at square one, but you give yourself more resources right at the start so that you can make more things right off the bat, essentially. And that just like propels you even further along the way to unlockables that cost way more, like stuff that you never would have been able to get your first time around. After you prestige, they become a little bit more viable to be able to reach. And that's what a lot of idle game developers are doing when they like pump updates out, are basically just adding more end game content so that you have more reason to keep playing and prestiging so that you can get to that later stuff.
Okay, so I'm hearing that this is a genre that appeals to people who are perpetually bored, and the incentive to develop these games is making money through ad revenue and microtransactions.
Essentially, but there are actually quite a few idle games that don't have any sort of revenue gain from them. They're just like essentially donation only. Like Cookie Clicker has no microtransactions. I don't think that it has any ads. I think if it does, it's like a very tiny banner across the top that you don't even notice when you're playing the game. And it's mostly supported by donations.
Okay.
Which honestly, like, more power to Orteal. I love people that are not resorting to microtransactions in today's game development climate, because that's such bullshit. But yeah, so essentially you're right. Like the bulk of the people who play idle games are people who either like, I would say that it's divided into like three primal categories of people, one of which being people who, like you said, are perpetually bored and have nothing else to do, so they just like sit in front of their screen and like click a cookie all day long. The second category of people being like people who want to play a game without actually really like playing a game per se. So like Cookie Clicker is the kind of game that you can just like have up and running on your computer whenever you're like busy doing something, like editing a podcast script or doing art homework. and basically just like turn your attention to it every once in a while to like click a golden cookie across the screen or like buy a couple of upgrades to set yourself up to make more cookies and then just go back to doing whatever it was that you were doing. Because it's a game that basically plays itself. So that would be the second category of people, followed by the third category of people, which is like people who are like hear about the game or are interested to play it for a little while and then very quickly run out of steam and get bored of it because there's not really a whole lot of point to it. I would say that that's a pretty solid description of idle games in general, which leads me to my favorite idle game of all time, which is Realm Grinder.
Bum, bum, bum.
So Realm Grinder is the apex of idle games. And yeah, it pulls components from the default template for idle games, but it also pulls components from just like regular games. So the one thing that really strikes me about Realm Grinder is the ability to pick whatever playstyle you want. So when it comes to idle games, a lot of games will give you not a whole lot of like different ways to play. There's essentially really only two schools of thought. The first is letting the thing idle, and the second is like clicking actively on the thing. So when it comes to Cookie Clicker, you can invest all of your cookies into upgrades that exclusively help your buildings that are automatically generating cookies for you, or you can invest your cookies into your clicking power. So every time you click on the cookie, you get more cookies from it. And that's generally like the only two, or at least the general concept is that you either actively click on the thing or you just let it sit there and idle and you can kind of buy your upgrades accordingly. Realm Grinder takes a step even further in that direction, in that customization of playstyle, in that it has different factions built into it. So the currency that you're generating is just like gold when you first start out. You just like have this little town that you're starting out and you buy gold and then you spend that gold on like buildings that you would have in a town, like a marketplace or I don't know, all kinds of stuff. It actually has a realistic concept. Like if you look at the description of Realm Grinder, the game description is as follows. Fancy being a benevolent king or a cruel tyrant? Choose an alignment between good and evil and form alliances with multiple races such as fairies, elves, angels, goblins, undead, and demons in order to improve your coin output. Click to harvest your treasure, build your almighty empire, unleash your magic upon the land, and be the richest ruler of the realm. So, lore-wise, Realm Grinder actually has a purpose. Like, you're essentially building up a city, you're building up a township, and you're affiliating yourself with a faction of creatures to help you accomplish that goal. So the things that you're building are like farms and inns, blacksmiths, things along that lines, like actual structures that generate some sort of revenue for you. And the creatures that you're affiliating yourself with have different mechanics associated with them based on the kind of playstyle that you would prefer. So, for example, there are elves, which when you click will help you generate more faction coins, which faction coins are affiliated with whatever faction that you're associating yourself with. So you generate more faction coins so you can buy more faction specific upgrades and also generally just help you accrue more gold on each click. Whereas something like undead, if you align yourself with the undead, they have a lot of upgrades that are specifically centered around offline coin production. So you log in, you buy a bunch of upgrades, set up a bunch of buildings, set up your build, and then close the game out. And while the game is closed, it generates a whole shit ton of coins because of your undead upgrades. When you log back in, you get all those coins and you can spend them. There's all sorts of different play styles. Realm Grinder also has spells that you can cast. If you align yourself with angels, then you have a mana pool and the spells that you can cast, your mana regenerates faster as you're aligned with angels. You have access to stronger spells. You can increase their effects, stuff like that. So really, it just depends on however you want to play the game, and Realm Grinder gives you the access to play the game however you want to. Granted, there's a completionist aspect of it where you unlock achievements and stuff, and the more achievements you get, you actually buff another faction. So it's really intertwined, and the prestiging mechanics go so ham in Realm Grinder. There's all kinds of different mechanics and functionality that you unlock. As you progress through the prestiging ranks, you essentially, there are like different tiers of prestiging within Realm Grinder. So there's like a level of prestige where you like reset everything and like inhibit the functionality of a lot of your buildings and factions and stuff, but give yourself a massive boost and like make all previous upgrades free to purchase and just all sorts of crazy stuff.
Is there a prestiging level where you have a twin brother and you kill him to seemingly create the perfect magic trick?
I think there's a reference here that I'm missing.
Oh, you've never seen The Prestige?
Oh, no, I have not.
Oh, it's got Hugh Jackman in it.
Actually, now that you're saying that, I think I like recently heard of it, but I haven't seen that.
Well, for once you didn't get my reference.
The tables have turned.
The student has become the teacher.
No, not quite. Oh, man. So, yeah. Anyway, I have been playing Realm Grinder for 2,204 hours on Steam.
That's not even a number of hours. There aren't even that many hours at all.
I don't know what that translates to, but basically I like consistently have Realm Grinder open on my computer all the time, constantly, because it's like, especially once you get into the late game, like you really only have very little to do in a day aside from just letting your game run and idle in the background. So like I log into Realm Grinder in the morning and I buy like 5 or 6 building upgrades and make sure that I like get all of the faction coins that I can and Royal Exchange them. And then I just leave my computer running for the rest of the day.
So once you get to like 3,000 hours of gameplay, does the game developer send you a condolences card on the death of your life?
No, but there's actually a Discord chat specifically for Realm Grinder, and like the person who has the highest Realm Grinder ascension level or reincarnation level, whatever, they have their own special like Discord like color and role, because they're just like the person who no-lifed the game the hardest. It's pretty great.
It sounds like losing and winning at the same time.
It a little bit is. But, okay, so when you're talking about games like League of Legends, those are games that have layers and layers and layers and layers of complexity into them. So, like, on top of just picking a champion, you also have to pick different runes and masteries associated with them. You also have to, like, know specifically how to play that champion and how to play that champion against basically any of the other champions in the game. You also have items that you have to build on that champion. And there's all kinds of strategy affiliated with League of Legends in every aspect. And accordingly, there are all sorts of different, like, fandom wikis and, like, officially, like, Riot Games, the publisher of League of Legends, will put out, like, videos on like strategies for different champions and stuff like that. And there's a whole like esports thing. Realm Grinder doesn't go that ham, but Realm Grinder has a massive collection of like wikis and forums and people posting strategy guides and different builds. It's really insane to me how in-depth this game gets and how massive the community's following is for it. And like just how many people out there, like there's this guy who has his own website built specifically to host all sorts of Realm Grinder information. Like basically just his website is just an encyclopedia for Realm Grinder, and people will like post builds there, like what their best upgrade, like research builds are, and like how to most effectively and efficiently obtain achievements and trophies and stuff. And it just blows my mind. Like I've been playing this game for so long and I'm still unlocking new content, and the developers are like actively publishing like seasonal events and they're putting out new updates. This game just goes ham. I love it so much.
Okay, so what would you say that the overall point of an idle game is?
If anything, perseverance.
Oh, it teaches you lessons?
I mean, no. Basically, the point of playing an idle game is just to derive as much enjoyment as you personally can derive from that kind of game. And for me, the appeal is sort of like an instant gratification thing. Like currently, I just recently started up a new build or a new save on Cookie Clicker, and I have cumulatively been playing the game for probably less than 3 or 4 days, and I'm already at a place where I'm generating 1 billion cookies per second. And
that's a lot of cookies.
It is. It is an insane quantity of cookies. I'm actually about to purchase my first antimatter condenser, which condenses the antimatter in the universe into cookies. But yeah, it's something that appeals to me, because if I'm actively trying to play a game, then I can play the game as actively as I want to by either clicking on the cookie a bunch of times or actively pursuing some sort of mini games that are affiliated within the game. Or if I'm like really busy and distracted with something, then I can just have the game running in the background and like not really pay any attention to it, and then come back later and I have all of this currency that was accrued for me while I was gone that I can readily spend. And it's just, it's fun for me, because the more you play the game and the farther along you go, the more rewarding it is for you, just because like the numbers get bigger, the stuff you can buy gets fancier, and I don't know. It's just an infinite supply of endorphins as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. So are these games targeted at what you would call casual gamers?
For sure. There are certain idle games that probably aren't so much. Like there's this idle game that I just recently discovered called like Heart of Galaxy or something like that. I can't remember what exactly it's called, but it's essentially like a universe colonization simulator in the form of an idle game.
So you basically start out on a planet that has resources available to you, and you can build up like tools, utilities to mine those resources, but you have to make sure that you equalize them so you don't run out of resources. So at the same time that you're harvesting resources, you're using things that, or you're building things that use those resources, but you want to make sure that you're harvesting them faster than you're using them, essentially. And then eventually you can like build up spaceports so that you can purchase ships to travel and colonize other planets where you have access to new resources. And sometimes you don't have access to resources that you need to use some of the tools that you need on other planets. So you have to like build transport ships that will transport resources back and forth between certain planets. That's by far probably one of the most intricate and like city building slash like colonization sim games that I've ever played. And it's really intriguing to me that they chose to go the idle game route for that. And I would say that that's probably not as casual, or it's definitely not geared toward casual gamers as much as games like Cookie Clicker are, because that's a very, very in-depth game. And that's something I would say is another really good selling point for me about Realm Grinder, is that the game has the capacity to be as complex as you want it to be, or not as complex as you want it to be, basically. Because you can delve really deep into the strategy and finding builds that are like the most efficient to maximize your coin production and stuff like that. Or you can just be somebody who's like, I just want to click on things and have stuff happen and be like, oh, I'm affiliated with fairies now. That's so cool. And I can cast fairy spells. You can be a super casual gamer, or you can be super hardcore about it. It really is just up to you.
Okay. So on a scale of chess to Battlefield 4, what do you rate idle games as a genre?
You're asking me to rate a game on a scale of other games?
Yeah.
That's not fair.
Well, I wouldn't make it easy on you.
I would give idle games as a genre somewhere between Monopoly and Uno. Like, super, super complex, but also actually fun, as opposed to Monopoly, which is just overly complex for no reason at all. Fuck you, Monopoly. I hate you.
I absolutely hate Monopoly more than almost anything.
Well, I'm glad we can agree on that, because Monopoly is terrible.
Yay, we agreed.
It's about damn time.
Thanks, Logan.
No problem.
Before we end this episode this week, I want to extend a public apology to Tom from the Dumb All Over podcast. I mistakenly called him out on his assessment as Kansas as a southern state. And it occurs to me now that I was completely mistaken, because when you live in Pennsylvania, everything south of Pennsylvania is a southern state. So you have my heartfelt apology, Tom. And that's the rear end of this week's show. We want to thank our favorite sodomites for their support, including Gaytheist, Lisa McLean, Holly Vane, and Sarah Talk Podcast. If you'd like to be the butt of a joke, you can be a patron too. Until next week, if you have questions or comments, please send us an email to podcast@waywardwillis.com. Intro music was provided by Austin Cologne and used with permission. You can find more of Austin's music linked in the show notes. This podcast is a media production of Willisware LLC. All rights reserved.
This has been The Wayward Willis. If you liked what you just heard and you want more of John and Logan, you can follow us on Twitter @WaywardWillis, Facebook @facebook.com/TheWaywardWillis, or at WillisWeb.com. If you want to help the show and have a few extra dollars, you can donate per episode or per month on Patreon at patreon.com/wayward. We'll be back next week.